STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Welcome to Stand to Reason. You'll probably notice there was no rooster crow at the beginning of this little intro. And you'll probably also notice that my voice sounds a little bit different. And there's a reason for that. In fact, if you're thinking this isn't Greg Kokel, let me assure you, you have good reason to think that. You are justified in that belief. That's because my name is Alan Schliemann. I'm one of the speakers here at Stand to Reason. And I am filling in here for Greg Kokel, who has the day off. But I also have with me here in the studio is my friend and colleague here at Stand to Reason, Amy Hall. Amy, welcome.
Thank you very much, Alan.
You're welcome. And we are here together to take your calls and chat with you about Christianity, about being an ambassador for Jesus Christ, which, as you know, and are familiar with Greg talking a lot about, we see ourselves in our roles as Christians as ambassadors for Jesus. We represent him in everything that we do and say and however we come across to other people. And so we want to talk about that and what that looks like with regards to a lot of the issues that we face today in our culture. And so if you want to join us on the show live today, you can give us a call. If you are local to us, the number is 855-243-9975. If you're calling outside of the United States, the number is 562-424-8229. And so if you want to call in now and get in the queue, you can do that. And we'll hopefully get a chance to talk to you about some things. In the meantime, we do have some thoughts that we want to share with you about some other things before we get to your calls. I also want to make mention, though, that there's another person who normally is here in the office that is not here today, and that is our other friend, Brett Kunkel, and colleague here at Stand to Reason, the other speaker. And that's because Brett Kunkel right now is in New Zealand. So he's not just out of the state, he's out of the country. And he's working right now with Rodney Lake at Thinking Matters in New Zealand. And if I recall, Amy, you were actually on a trip with Brett also a couple of years ago to New Zealand. And you guys did some work out there with Rodney Lake. Is that correct?
Yeah, we went out there with Brett and I went out there and then from LTI. Oh, I'm totally blanking on his name.
Jay Watts. Yeah. Our good friend Jay Watts.
We all went out there and we did some speaking. We did some events, different conferences and schools, and we had the best time. The best time. New Zealand is so beautiful and the people are wonderful. Rodney was great, and it was so great to be part of something down there, of bringing apologetics down there and helping Rodney to get that started. It was really exciting.
Yeah, and I understand you did some speaking as well there, didn't you?
I did, yeah.
What did you cover when you were there?
I talked about the problem of evil, and it's actually online. People could look it up, find it, look up Problem of Evil in Amy Hall, and you should be able to find it there. And I did a lot of Q&A and different things when we had events, so.
Yeah, actually, Amy has done a whole bunch of things and worn a lot of hats here at Stand to Reason. In fact, when I started here about, I think it was 10 years ago, you were actually doing the scheduling for Brett and me, right?
That's right.
So you were booking events for us and kind of managing our calendar. Since then, I know you've also had the pleasure or the challenge of dealing with our newsletters. And so I remember for a time also you were taking the newsletters that I write to my donors and that Brett writes to his donors and that eventually also get posted as articles on the blog. You were taking those and helping edit them and formatting them, getting them printed out. And then, of course, as we mentioned, you've also done some speaking here and there. And then now, primarily, though, you're working on the blog. Is that right?
Yeah. So now, primarily, I'm doing content creation and mostly on the blog. So I manage the blog and make sure there's something on there every day except Sundays. And so I've been covering that and working on the blog and answering people's questions and interacting with people there, and I love it.
Yeah, that is so awesome. Amy is seriously a fantastic apologist, a first-rate thinker. I know Greg often turns to her for feedback, for ideas, for thoughts. All the posts that she puts on the blog that I read, I just think, man, she helps to refine my thinking. And so I know all of us at Stand to Reason are super excited and privileged to have you on the team. So we're really glad you're part of what we're doing here.
Thanks, Helen.
Yeah, no problem. She didn't ask me to say that. That's totally real. So but going back to the New Zealand thing, is there anything that you remember that was quite memorable for you? Anything that you guys saw when you were there that you enjoyed? And because I know the whole Lord of the Rings thing is a big deal for people in New Zealand, and of course people who visit New Zealand. But I know you enjoy that as well too. And
yes, we did visit the Shire.
Yes.
We did go to visit that place, and that was great. We did some hiking out in in the bush, they call it, and all sorts of things. But one of the most humbling things was that the people we met, some of them actually follow Stand to Reason and had used our material to do debates and to do different things. And when I heard about that, it's amazing to think that something I'm doing here in the little corner of the office is affecting people on the other side of the world. It's amazing the opportunities we have with the internet and just a way to reach a lot of people all at once.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I found that the same thing to be true with me as well, that you travel to different places and you run across lots of people elsewhere, far from where we are located, and find that, yeah, Stand to Reason is having a huge impact. And yeah, we're super humbled to be a part of that process. So again, we want to have a chance to talk to you guys today. So if you want to call in again, the local number here calling from the United States is 855-243-9975. And outside the United States, the number is 562-424-8229. But for just a moment here, I wanted to comment on something that I've seen a lot of news reports have been about these days. And it has to do with the issue of conversion therapy or reparative therapy. And just to kind of give you a little bit of the backstory that prompted this whole conversation that our national culture, the culture is now having discussion about, was with respects to a person named Joshua Alcorn, who was a teenager. And Joshua Alcorn, I think at about the age of 14, came out to his parents and said that he was, or he believed to be, a girl. And at that point, he was calling himself Leela Alcorn, which of course is a female name. And according to the story, and again, I haven't researched or investigated the accuracy of all the details of the story, but the large contours of the story are the fact that last year, Joshua Alcorn walked out onto a freeway and committed suicide. And of course, this is extremely tragic. Nobody wanted to see that. Nobody wanted to have that happen to him. But the story was that after he came out to his parents and said that he believed himself to be a girl in a man's body, that his parents resisted this idea that he was a girl. They apparently were Christian parents and encouraged him to not identify as a girl. According to other reports, they sent him to some type of a therapy in order to help him overcome these beliefs, these feelings, confusion, whatever they call it. And as a result of that, Joshua Alcorn felt torn about this and eventually penned a note talking about why he's committing suicide and hoping that in his death, somehow things will change for the better in the future. So again, just a really, really sad situation that happened to him. Now, as a result of that, in December, a whole bunch of articles started to get printed and written, and people started talking about this issue of conversion therapy and saying, look how harmful it is. In fact, already in California and in New Jersey and Washington, D.C., we have laws that have been passed that ban therapy for minors, so under 18 years old, for these minors who want to pursue having their unwanted same-sex attraction be overcome. Now, in addition to these laws that have been passed, we've seen actually a lot of non-Christians, of course, who have come out and said, we need to stop conversion therapy. This is wrong. This is hurtful. It's dangerous. We've even had many Christians who have come out and said, yeah, we're not sure that reparative therapy is a good thing. It sounds like it's harmful. Perhaps we should stop this. Even in the last, within the last few weeks, President Obama in the White House has come out as well, supporting bans on conversion therapy. So, I mean, this has gotten a ton of attention on all different levels. And the reason why I bring this up is because I'm frustrated by a lack of clarity and nuance on what I believe to be, and I think what a lot of people believe to be, a very important topic. And the problem that we're seeing is that people are not defining their terms. They are not defining what they are referring to when they use the word conversion therapy or reparative therapy or other kinds of therapies that attempt to change someone's sexual orientation. And I want to give you an example of what I'm talking about in a recent article that came out on Thursday, April 16th, 2015. It was published in, I think this is a British news site called The Independent, and it is written by Vicky Beeching, who is, according to her website, a theologian. She's a writer, a broadcaster, and a keynote speaker. I think a lot of people also know her as a Christian singer, or at least formerly she used to be involved in singing. I don't know to what degree she still does that. But nevertheless, she wrote this article, and here's the title of the article. It's this: I tried to pray the gay away and ended up in a hospital bed. And it's subtitled, I still bear the scars of being told that I could change my orientation. So here you have Vicky Beeching. Of course, it's not news that she is gay or lesbian. I think she came out with regards to that story about a year ago or so. But now she's coming out and saying that she tried to pray away the gay and it didn't work and it ended up putting her in a hospital bed. And so the idea is that this type of therapy has harmed her. And I want to just read to you a couple of parts that she talks about in her story that gives you some understanding of what's going on here. And here's what she writes. I told a Catholic priest at the age of 14, hoping that he could pray away the gay. He heard from my formal confession and said a prayer of forgiveness over me. That didn't work. And as a result, my sense of shame increased. At 16, I attended a church meeting where people stood at the front and shared how God had set them free from various struggles, including one girl who said she'd be free and she had been freed from homosexuality. So, Vicky says, I asked Christians at the meeting to pray for me to stop having same-sex attraction. The prayer session didn't work, she writes. And then she says, to escape the feelings I was having toward another woman, I threw myself into my job and became a total workaholic by the time I reached my mid-20s. And believing I'd never be able to have a life partner, I buried the pain of taking on more and more work until my body grew so stressed and exhausted that I developed an autoimmune condition. Laying in a hospital bed, undergoing chemotherapy to treat it, I realized I needed to reassess my life and come to terms with being gay. I came out in an interview with The Independent last summer at the age of 35. I still bear the scars of being told I could change my orientation if I just prayed hard enough, and the shame and trauma that results from those teachings and those practices. Now, let me just pause right here, because at this point, some of you might even be wondering, well, wait a minute. Was her request of having someone to pray the gay away the cause of her ending up in a hospital bed? Because it sure sounds like there's something else going on, that perhaps her turning to being a workaholic, overbooking herself, whatever it might be, led to her developing this sort of autoimmune disorder because of exhaustion, because of fatigue. And so there might be something about that question as to whether the title of this article is necessarily a fair title, which is, I tried to pray the gay away and ended up in a hospital bed. Maybe it isn't necessarily that sort of cause and effect that led to her being put in that situation. But regardless of that, I want to point out what she does next in the article. The very next paragraph starts off critiquing and attacking conversion therapy. She says, conversion therapy, therefore, is often justified by its practitioners because, quote, everyone deserves the right to seek help if they want it. And then she goes on to talk about how she believes conversion therapy should be banned, that it's harmful and dangerous, as in the case as it happened to her. And this is sort of the similar kind of story that we see where people are taking methods, various methods, whether it be prayer or pastoral counseling or, chemical castration, and lumping them under the heading of conversion therapy or reparative therapy or sexual orientation change efforts. And the reason why this is a problem is because, specifically when I'm referring to the term reparative therapy, this is not a general term that refers to all methods of changing someone's same-sex attraction. Now, I realize that this is the way most people are using them. They use the terms conversion therapy or reorientation therapy as these general terms to sort of refer to all of the different methods that possibly could be used to help someone overcome their same-sex attraction. But reparative therapy actually turns out to be a specific type of therapy that is not just some general term. In fact, it's such a specific therapy that most marriage and family therapists have not been trained or are familiar with how to use it. Very few people I've ever met have been trained in it. Now, I have met many people because I've been studying reparative therapy, reading books about it, attending conferences, and know quite a number of therapists who actually practice it. But it is not a general catch-all term to refer to all forms of physical therapy. I'm sorry, not physical therapy. I said physical therapy because I used to be a physical therapist. I mean, it's not a catch-all term to refer to all methods of changing someone's same-sex attraction. Now, reparative therapy, by the way, has somewhat of a bad PR, if you will, and partly, I understand, because of its name, reparative therapy, makes it sound like reparative therapists or the therapist who's engaging in it is engaging in some type of fixing of the client, that there's something wrong with the client that they're trying to fix, and it just sounds awfully mechanical and impersonal. Now, the problem with that understanding is, besides the fact that it's mistaken, is that the term reparative has nothing to do with what the therapist is doing, but rather it's a reference to what is going on with the homosexual man or woman. And the reason why I say that is because the term reparative has to do with the homosexual urge that homosexuals experience. And the reason why they say this is because people who study psychology and this question of what causes same-sex attractions realize that for many, although not all, many homosexuals have been psychologically wounded. And their own psyche, their own psychological profile attempts to repair that wound by seeking out same-sex urges, by pursuing same-sex urges or expressing themselves as same-sex urges. In other words, the homosexual drive is a reparative drive. It is an attempt subconsciously by a person to try to repair the psychological wounds that occur to them. And that's why I say it's important to recognize that the term reparative therapy, the term reparative, is a reference to what is going on in the homosexual, not what the therapist is doing. So now, having said that, when I hear people refer to the term reparative therapy or they say, oh, we should ban reparative therapy, we should ban conversion therapy, I know they're not referring to genuine reparative therapy. How do I know that? Because when they describe what they're talking about, it doesn't sound anything like genuine reparative therapy. So for example, Whitehouse.gov, which is the blog of the White House, has written actually a number of articles about this on their blog. They actually have a YouTube video on this as well. But they write this: conversion therapy is a practice in which doctors try to convince LGBTQ plus people to change their sexual orientation or gender identity. It's wrong and it's dangerous, end quote. Now, again, I know this is not reparative therapy because therapists and clients, when they're engaged in reparative therapy, work towards identifying goals and objectives that are defined by the client, not by the therapist. In other words, if you ever have a situation in which a therapist is telling you, these are the goals, I want to convince you that this is what you should do with your life, and I as a therapist will help you to achieve that, you can know this is not reparative therapy. In fact, many reparative therapists will say that oftentimes when the client comes to them and begins to find out what are the goals of the client, and the client says, well, look, I'm actually okay with my same-sex attractions. I don't want to overcome them at all. The reparative therapist many times will just go along with that and say, that's fine. I'm not going to try to have you overcome your same-sex attractions. I'm perfectly fine working on other goals that you have, maybe dealing with your depression or some other kind of psychological condition you might have. Another example are of the people where they report that children or teenagers have been dragged to therapy against their will and forced to undergo therapy. And again, reparative therapy doesn't work that way. In fact, reparative therapy can't work unless the client themselves is asking for help, is asking for help in how to overcome their same-sex attractions and are willingly engaging and working with the therapist. And so by not distinguishing between real reparative therapy and all the other wacky stuff that gets included under the term reparative therapy when people are using it, like praying away the gay or chemical castration or forcing people to undergo therapy, by confusing these two understandings of genuine reparative therapy and this general term for all sort of reorientation therapy, we are causing a lot of confusion about what the real stuff is. And the problem is that people want to then abolish and ban all forms of reparative therapy, even the legitimate ones. And of course, by doing that, we're going to be denying people who have unwanted same-sex attraction with a chance to get real help and healing. And indeed, over the years that I've met reparative therapists and their clients, I've found that these people, meaning the clients, have not in any way been harmed. They've actually found great freedom and healing and restoration in their lives. So there's a huge benefit that comes from that. And so anyways, I hope that this clarifies some of the misunderstanding with reparative and conversion therapy and the efforts to try to ban it. Remember, the term reparative therapy is not a catch-all term that refers to all forms and all methods of trying to change someone's sexual attractions. Rather, there's a specific type of therapy that it refers to. And of course, people aren't making this distinction, and that's why there's so much confusion on this subject. We are just up here, up against a break, so we're going to take a break here in a minute and then come back with some of your questions and other comments. So I'm Alan Schliemann here with Amy Hall in studio, guest hosting for Greg Kokel, who's got the day off, and we'll be right back in just a moment with Stand to Reason.
If you lack the time to wade through thick volumes to get a solid grasp of tough topics, STR has a short and sweet solution. Our ambassador's guides are quick reads that give you easily digestible answers to crucial concerns you face as a Christian ambassador. Each volume in this series equips you with the information and outlook you need to understand an issue confronting Christians today. When you visit the STR store at str.org, you'll find a library of ambassador's guides, including guides to Mormonism, Islam, postmodernism, the New Atheists, pluralism, understanding homosexuality, and the voice of God. To order copies and become a better equipped and more knowledgeable ambassador, visit the online store at str.org or call 800-2-REASON. That's 800-273-2766.
Hi, I'm Alan Schliemann. Would you like to see the effects of same-sex marriage before it's legalized in the United States? I'll tell you how you can do that in this month's episode of my podcast, Thinking Out Loud. Look for it on iTunes or the bottom of the homepage at str.org.
Okay, welcome back. We are here at Stand to Reason. I'm Alan Schliemann. I'm in studio with Amy Hall. We are guest hosting for the Stand to Reason show today because Greg Kokel has the day off.
And I actually have some questions for you, Alan, regarding the first part of the show where you were talking about reparative therapy. And my first question is, do you personally know people who have been helped or who have not been helped by this? And also, what exactly, because I don't really have a lot of knowledge about this, and a lot of what you just said is new to me. So what is it that reparative therapists are trying to address? Mm-hmm. Like what would you say that they're trying to do there?
Sure. Okay, so let's just go to the first question here with regards to do I know people who've experienced this? Yes, I know a lot of people. And the reason is because over the years I've attended a number of different conferences where psychologists, physicians, psychotherapists, clinicians, and other counselors have attended these conferences in order to become more equipped in understanding of reparative therapy and how it works. Now, these conferences, they don't necessarily just focus on reparative therapy, but that's certainly one of the ones that they do talk about. And in the process of that, I've met many people who, of course, shared their testimonies at these conferences and who have greatly benefited from reparative therapy. And contrary to all the things that you hear in the press about how people have been damaged or hurt or wounded or have been driven to increase depression, this is not the case with the people who I know who have experienced genuine, bona fide reparative therapy. Now, I'm not saying that people, some people have pursued these other forms of therapy that perhaps didn't work. Maybe, I mean, I'm willing to grant that there are a number of different illegitimate, dangerous, harmful attempts to help people overcome same-sex attraction that don't work. So I'm not denying that that's not the case.
You mentioned shock therapy. Is that really something that goes on for this? Or
So historically, there has been electroshock therapy that's been used for the purposes of various clinical conditions, as well as with homosexual orientations. I've heard some people make reference to the fact that they think there are some Christian groups that still do this. But based on some investigations, we found out that this is a bogus claim, and we haven't found out any solid evidence that people still do this. If there are, I'm pretty certain that these people would be told to stop what they're doing, or certainly not allowed their license to continue if that was the case, that they were actually practicing electroshock therapy still.
So what exactly are they doing? What are they trying to correct?
Well, with reparative therapy, as I mentioned, that it is a reference to the fact that the person who has same-sex attractions has perhaps been psychologically wounded, typically at a very early age in their own childhood development. And as a result of that wounding, they have developed an, sometimes they would call it defensive detachment or an ill-at-easeness towards them, like, for example, talking about men. For the person who becomes a male homosexual, they've developed an ill-at-easeness from the male gender. So as a child, something has happened, perhaps sexual abuse, perhaps physical abuse or emotional abuse or psychological abuse. Perhaps their father was absent, passive, not willing to affirm them as a man. I mean, there's all sorts of things that could have contributed to this. And I'm not going to do this justice because I'm obviously not a clinician who practices this. But having spoken to a number of reparative therapists, this is the way that I understand it's what's going on, is that a child at a very young age has had a wound psychologically to their own development. And as a result of that wound has developed a defensive detachment towards the male gender. And as a result, they have not looked to the male gender to develop their own sense of male gender identity. As a result, when they reach puberty, they have a desire then, a subconscious desire to repair that male gender deficit. And that drive to repair that male gender identity deficit is a reparative drive. That's why they call it reparative therapy, because the reparative therapist is trying to identify that initial psychological wound, help them overcome it, which will then help to diminish the same-sex attractions that are a natural result of the wound.
So you the people that you know that have not been helped by this, how do they now view it, the therapy?
Well, I guess to clarify, I would say that the people who I know have not been helped by it. They weren't necessarily people who experienced reparative therapy. They were people who experienced other forms of therapy. Now, I'm not saying that all reparative therapy works 100% of the time. I'm just simply saying that the people that I know who have pursued therapy and it hadn't worked or hasn't worked, they told me that they weren't using. They didn't attend a session that was performed by a reparative therapist, but rather by other people who were engaging in other forms of therapy. And they just simply said, well, it didn't work. It may have helped me with some issues. It helped me with some of my insecurity feelings or my depression, but overall I still have same-sex attraction. And that's an important point to clarify, by the way, and that is that many people who undergo various forms of therapy, some have small changes that occur in their attractions. Some have no changes in their attractions. Some have dramatic changes in their same-sex attraction and have very diminished same-sex attractions and now experience heterosexual attractions. So it's not an on-off switch. It's not like you either have them or you don't. It falls under a whole continuum. And by the way, the secular research bears this out. When you see what secular research says about gender identity, it's not an on-off switch. It's a whole continuum of where people fall on the gender identity scale.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that because I've read articles by, especially recently, as you said, this has come up again, articles from people who are very against the therapy. But the arguments that I've seen are they promise that you will be completely changed and they fail. And so it's a false promise. But you're saying that they're just like with any depression or anything, you could have various levels of help with that.
That's right.
That's the expectation.
That's right. And if there's been people who have tried to pitch this therapy as, hey, you can go from 100% same-sex attracted to 100% opposite-sex attracted, well, this is, first of all, misleading. But usually what I hear is that the people who are sort of on the pro-gay advocate side, they're the ones who are trying to say, look, we know it doesn't work because we don't see people go from 100% same-sex attracted to 100% opposite-sex attracted. And the point that you're bringing up is correct, and that is that in any kind of clinical therapy, whether it's treating depression or bipolar or whatever it might be, for someone to go from, say, having a predominant condition which they find undesirable to having that condition reduced by, say, 40% or 20% or 50% would be still constituted as success, would still be constituted as something that is helpful and worthwhile. And so since homosexual attractions and the causes of same-sex attraction oftentimes are also related to the same kind of psychological progression that can occur with any psychological condition, we would expect the same kinds of results as well, that some people will have small changes, some people might have large changes. But this doesn't in any way constitute a proof that therefore the therapy didn't work. But that's often the way the other side tries to portray this. Right. See, they didn't have 100% change. They still have some residual same-sex attraction. So therefore, it didn't work. And actually, I have even close friends who used to have same-sex attraction that no longer do today. And then I have some that actually have some residual forms of same-sex attraction still. And then I have some that are just completely still same-sex attracted. So I have friends all along the continuum of that area. But all of them will still say, man, I'm a much better place today than I was many years ago.
Have you heard the people that you've talked to at these conferences, have you heard any talk of what they're going to do if this is made illegal? Is there talk about making this illegal for everyone or just children as it is here in California?
Well, as I mentioned, in California, New Jersey, and Washington, D.C., they've passed laws. I think the law in California has had some challenges to it, so I don't know if it's taken effect. But these areas have laws that have passed, and they are particularly for minors, so under the age of 18. Now, what clinicians have been saying about this is, look, this is obviously a threat to our profession and to our livelihood. So certainly they are pursuing legal efforts to try to stop such laws from remaining in effect. Now, obviously, with the president and the White House raising the issue and now it becoming a sort of a national question, there's concern that this could be federally prohibited. And of course, this would be have huge ramifications, because I know some therapists have even left different states in order to move to states where it's still permissible to practice it. So, yeah, they're definitely concerned.
I did have some thoughts, because right so far we've just talked about psychological ramifications and things like that. But going back to the Vicky Beeching, is that her name?
Mm-hmm.
And now, am I remembering right that when she came out, she's saying that this is something that is right for her. She's not just saying she has attraction. She's saying that this is the lifestyle she's leading. Am I remembering that right?
Yeah. Well, I think you're correct. I didn't read her original coming out story, but based on the article that I read here, where she's talking about praying the gay away and how it didn't work, mm-hmm. she's clearly saying that, look, we need to move forward with accepting homosexuality within the church. I know. In fact, I'm just looking here for. Here it is, the very end of her article, she writes, I long to see the day when the church teaches a positive, inclusive message that you do not have to choose between your faith and your sexuality. And of course, she talks about how Christianity is gradually moving in an LGBT inclusive direction, and that is heartening to watch. So it certainly sounds like she's definitely affirming of homosexuality and Christianity being, of course, wet together and not a problem.
Listening to that story, what strikes me about it is that it seems like there's almost a low view of the gospel in what she went through. And what I mean by that is that since it didn't stop those feelings for her, somehow she felt like she was driven to make that better in order to be in the church. Like that, but In reality, the answer to the pain of not being able to change isn't to get rid of the therapy, and it isn't to deny that there's something wrong. The answer is to have a high view of the gospel, that we are forgiven and we are accepted in Christ, even with all of our sin,
mm-hmm.
even while we have that sin,
mm-hmm.
and even in our pain of that sin. And it almost sounds like she didn't have an understanding of that the church, that she wasn't resting in the gospel, but somehow in order to overcome the pain she was having, she had to deny it was a problem at all.
Mm-hmm.
And that was her way out. And I feel terrible about that. I feel like, you know, the church needs to be careful. We need to be careful that we're not saying that becoming heterosexual is your salvation.
That's right.
And maybe, you know, maybe I don't know what her church was telling her at the time, but I just wish that would be the first place we would go as Christians, rather than having feeling like we have to deny our sin.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. In fact, oftentimes when I teach on the topic of homosexuality, I close with a point saying, look, our goal, our hope for people who identify as gay or lesbians, for these homosexual people, is not heterosexuality, but holiness, right? Our desire is for them not to become straight, but our goal is to lead them straight to Jesus Christ. And in fact, every situation in where I've seen a person who's been self-identified as gay or lesbian, who has eventually abandoned living consistently with their same-sex attractions, it was because they first accepted Jesus Christ. And the Holy Spirit came inside them and transformed them from the inside out. And then, as a result, they felt convicted by their own feelings and proclivities, and then lived a life of obedience. And so I think you make a great point, and I'm really glad you mentioned that.
And I hope it gives comfort to people who are listening. I'm sure there are people listening to us right now who have same-sex attractions, and I hope it's a comfort to them to know that even, you know, not everyone who's a Christian do those feelings go away, but that they're still accepted in Christ, and that, like you said, the goal is obedience and holiness. I want Christians to understand that and really rest in that.
Yeah, and that's totally true. I mean, that's the case for all of us. I mean, all of us, even as believers who have the Holy Spirit living in us, still have proclivities that we feel are innate, natural, that are wrong-headed. You know, they're proclivities towards sin and sinful behavior. And so the fact that they don't go away doesn't in any way give us justification then to say, oh, okay, well, then therefore they're okay, and this is a part of who I am. It might be a part of who you are and what's being expressed in your own kind of soul, but it doesn't mean that those things are right. And so, as you pointed, you know, we want to live lives that are holy and honoring to God, not give into whatever proclivities that we're having, and just because they don't go away, that therefore we're going to accept them.
Right.
Yeah, so I think it's a good point. Thanks for sharing that. All right, well, we are coming up against another break here in a minute, and the person who originally was called in hung up, but we're going to still try to address your question in a minute. Oh, we can do it? Oh, you're back on. Okay, wonderful. So let's go ahead and take the call, but do we have enough time? All right, let's go ahead and take a break, and we'll get to that call in just a minute. I'm Alan Schliemann and Amy Hall here, guest hosting for Greg Kokel on Standard Reason.
Carry STR with you by downloading our Stand to Reason and Quick Reference apps for free. Both are available for iPhone, iPad, and Android. From your STR app, listen to the weekly podcast, speaker podcasts, check out the STR blog, Access Solid Ground, Greg's mentoring letters, and more. The Quick Reference app gives you the tools you need to answer the toughest questions Christians face, all through the easy-to-read text and short videos. You'll have STR resources at your fingertips in a clean layout with great features and functionality. And they're free. So download the apps today and start carrying STR with you everywhere you go.
Would you like Greg, Brett, or Alan to come and speak at a location near you? Find out how you can invite them to your area by visiting the speaker section at str.org. Our speakers are accomplished and compelling presenters who address from a biblical standpoint topics like abortion, homosexuality, and evolution, as well as apologetics, theology, and evangelism. They're available to teach lectures and seminars, preach sermons, and lead workshops at single events or weekend-long conferences. Their aim is to help Christians like you effectively engage the culture around you with knowledge, wisdom, and character. To schedule Greg, Brett, or Alan today, send an email to Melinda or Danielle. To learn more, visit str.org/training/speakers.
Welcome back. This is Stand to Reason, and you are not listening to Greg Kokla right now because you have here Alan Schliemann and Amy Hall, two Stand to Reason staff that are filling in for Greg. Greg has the day off. He's taking a break. He deserves it. We could all attest to that. So, but we are glad here to be filling in for Greg and willing to take your questions and comments. The number again for those of you in the United States is 855-243-9975 if you want to give us a call. And outside the United States, the number is 562-424-8229. We want to go to Eric here in California who's got a question for us. How you doing, Eric? You're here with Alan and Amy.
I'm doing good. How are you?
Good, good. Where in California do you live?
L.A.?
Oh, L.A. You're very close to us. We can hear you outside, in fact, perhaps.
No, I'm not. I'm actually in the dorm.
Oh, okay. I was just kidding.
Yeah, well, anyways.
What's on your mind?
My question is, when should you consider moving churches and why?
Oh, okay. Yeah, the question you had for our screener, I think, was a little bit different. I thought you were asking about advice for a friend of yours, perhaps, with regards to studying the Bible. But is that related to this question?
Not necessarily. But that question also refers to the people in the movement, the Young Restless Reform Movement.
Oh, okay.
Any cautions that you want to watch out for the people that are in that movement?
Well, I can start with a question about when you should leave a church and why. It's obviously really difficult because I think it's important to have roots in a church. I think it's important to have community and to be close to people, and that takes a lot of time to develop. So I would never leave on a whim or quickly in any way. But I would say, because recently I spent a long time looking for a church, and the biggest problem I had was that I would go to a church and they would open up the Bible and they would think they were talking about the Bible. But in reality, what they would do is read a verse and then they would use that as a jumping off point to talk about something we needed to change in our lives, something we needed to some kind of moralistic solution to our lives. And they never actually talked about the text. They never actually talked about God. God was never the subject of the sermon. We didn't hear the gospel. We could work our way through an entire book and get to the end of it. And I would think, I can guarantee nobody in this church could explain to me what that book was about, what that whole book of the Bible is about, because they never actually talked about the text. They just used it as a jumping off point for their mm-hmm. sermon on whatever they wanted to do a sermon on that week. I can compare it to this. Like if you were to go to a book club for Lord of the Rings, and you loved Lord of the Rings, and every week you would go to this book club to talk about Lord of the Rings, and you got there and someone said, "All right, today we're going to talk about how Aragorn was very courageous. Courage is blah, 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 and courage is this, and courage is that." But they never actually talked about how Aragorn was courageous. They're not actually talking about the book. And that it's important to me to have a church where they're actually talking about what the book is talking about. And also that they would actually tell us the gospel, that they would hold Jesus up for us to worship and to see and to adore. So that's another thing that I wasn't seeing in a lot of churches. So if you go and you're getting nothing but lists of things you need to do, that is going to wear you out. The thing that will give you life is hearing the gospel and seeing Jesus and seeing who he is, and that's and letting the Holy Spirit work through you in that. So I would say if they're giving you a list of things to do every week and that's what their sermons are, that would be a reason to leave. That's the one that comes to my mind. Does anything...
Eric, I'm curious, without necessarily identifying the name of the church or, you know, I'm not looking for identifying details of where you're attending, but could you tell us perhaps what's going on that's causing you to question whether you or whoever it is considering leaving a church? Is there something specific that's come up?
You know, I just have a couple of friends of mine that attend churches, and, you know, just like you were mentioning how, you know, they preach sermons on based on the law and what you have to do instead of the gospel, so...
I mean, it's...
Were you asking for yourself, or were you asking for your friends?
For a friend.
Okay. Does he feel like he might want to leave, or are you noticing something that you think he should notice and want to leave?
It's rather I'm noticing something based on what he was telling me.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the bottom line is if they're not preaching the gospel, but they're doing something else, then of course that's an obvious red flag. So certainly you'd want to go to a church that's more biblically based for that concern. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Good. Then you were asking something else that had come up as well. Is that right? Did you have another question?
You heard about the Young Restless Reform Movement, yes?
I have not.
Yeah, just the kind of resurgence of Calvinism in younger congregations. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah.
Yeah, so what was your question about that?
For anyone in that movement, do you guys have any cautions or anything that you guys want the younger people in that movement to look out for or to be aware of?
I would say, you know, it's funny, but the older I get, the more I appreciate tradition and liturgy and that sort of thing, because I see how it keeps people on track. And so I would, if you're talking about kind of newer churches that are trying to kind of take a new approach or trying to do things that are more hip or whatever. I would just be careful. I tend to gravitate now toward churches that are what's the word? More grounded in history and that sort of thing. So I don't know. I think every church has its problems, so it's kind of hard to say a blanket statement. I also think that churches are missing out in kind of a reverential aspect towards God. Some churches have gone so far to be casual. I've even heard a church say, you know, the pastor get up there and get upset with people for being late or being casual. And all I can think is, well, you're kind of cultivating a casual atmosphere here. You can't really be surprised when people treat church casually. I would really like to see churches be much more reverential, and that doesn't mean changing the music or anything. I just mean just maybe that is the way you dress a little bit. Maybe there are certain limits that I would have that maybe some churches don't have. So I think any kind of a new church that's trying to create a new kind of church, I think they need to be careful about being reverential and kind of creating an atmosphere of awe towards God. And being really kind of deliberate about that, I guess. Those are really my only thoughts.
Does that make sense, Eric? Does that help?
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else?
For now, that's it. Thank you.
Okay, you
bet. All right, thanks a lot, Eric.
Thanks, Eric. Talk to you later.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, so, thanks for providing that overview for him. I think that was helpful. I wanted to talk to you also about some things that you've been doing specifically on the blogs. I know that you've been working hard to have that as an active part of what Stand to Reason is doing. And like you said, it has huge global outreach. And I know that you've done a number of unique things on the blog in order to attract more people and get people thinking about things and not just providing just written information that people can read. Could you share maybe one or two of some of those things that you found that's been helpful there?
There are three regular features that we have on the blog that I think podcast listeners would be interested in. And the first one is, and Greg has mentioned this on the show before, but maybe not as specifically as I'm about to. Every week during the show, I keep track of any guest, any book, any article, anything that Greg mentions on the air, plus articles that I know of that are related that maybe he didn't even know about. And what I do is I go on the blog and I post all of those links in the order under the questions in which they were asked. And so that you can go to the blog and you can find anything that you've heard mention it. So tomorrow I'll post that Vicki mm-hmm. Beeching article. Because I get questions a lot from people, you know, Greg mentioned so-and-so on the air. Who was that? Well, it's really easy. If you just go to str.org/blog and you look for links mentioned on the, so today it'll be the 4/21/15 show, mm-hmm. but they're all in there by date. You just click right on that. You can also get there from the podcast page. So there's a link on the podcast page that says find a guest article, you know, whatever. Click on that. That'll take you to the page that's connected to that podcast. You can find anything that was mentioned on that show. And at the bottom of the links post, you'll find a link to all the links posts. So if you want to search older ones, you can just skim through all of those at once. So that's one thing I think people will be interested in. Secondly, we do the biweekly challenges. I will post, I search the internet. I kind of pick things out that I hear a lot. And they're not always difficult, but we don't always get difficult questions from people. We need to learn how to respond to questions that are crazy. We need to learn how to respond to questions that are difficult, easy, whatever. So what the goal of the challenge is to give people practice in answering objections to Christianity. So what I'll do is I'll post a question, an objection, that sort of thing. And then for 2 days, people can try their hand at answering that question in the mm-hmm. comments. So that goes on for a couple of days. And then on Thursday, either Alan or Brett will post a video, and that video will give their response to the question. And so then after you've had a chance to practice, you get to see, how did I do? You know, what did Alan think? And it's great. And it spawns a lot of conversation. We have some regular atheists who come on and comment, and they're there pretty regularly. Yes. So you could even have a chance, but you don't have to interact with atheists. You can just throw your answer out there and see how it does. See if the atheists respond to it. See how they would challenge that answer. And it's good practice. Nobody knows who you are. It's an easy way to get, you know, to practice answering people's questions.
And then what are some of the topics, broadly speaking, that we get challenges on that eventually we answer? Like, what is the range? It could be anything on related to apologetics. Is it theology? Is it?
It's all sorts of things. It can be, you know, Christians are mean. It can be Jesus never said he was God. Today one went up, and it's religions are products of culture and geography, not truth. And I think Brett's answering this one on Thursday. So it's just whatever I come across that day, whatever I, you know, have been hearing. Usually I try to get things that I've heard before, not just random things. And it's good practice. It's good practice.
Yeah, that's great.
So then the third feature that we have that's a regular feature right now is we started a book club. And we're talking about Nancy Piercy's new book, Finding Truth, 5 Principles for Unmasking Atheism, Secularism, and Other God Substitutes. And she was on the show just a few weeks ago. I can't remember the exact date. Mm-hmm. But if you could find that interview, I'll have to look it up. Maybe I can give the date later. Actually, I will post it tomorrow on the links post. What we're doing is we're reading through this book one chapter at a time, and then people can come on and they can interact in the comments. Again, we have some atheists who are challenging it and giving some surprising challenges that I wasn't expecting. Like we've had some people on there who are objecting to the idea that they have a worldview. And that's been kind of interesting. And I'm not even really sure why that's important to them, but it's important to them that we know that they do not have a worldview.
Well, perhaps they think that if they do have a worldview, that's something they have to defend.
That's probably part of it.
Because they often will say something like, well, you know, I don't believe in God. You believe in God, so I don't have to defend anything.
Yeah. Okay?
But of course, if you don't believe in God, then your worldview is this form of naturalism. But if you're a naturalist, it doesn't mean you're off the hook. You still have to explain, well, what's your understanding of how the universe came into existence? How do you explain objective morality? Or do you believe in objective morality? You know, why does anything matter at all? I mean, on your worldview, you still have to give those answers. Otherwise, your worldview is going to look rather unimpressive.
And, right? And even people who say, I can't know anything, that's still a worldview. Because you're saying you can only know, or you can't know because you're trapped behind your perceptions or your senses or whatever, and then you have no way to know that those senses are capturing reality. That's a worldview.
That's right.
That's a perspective. And I wish more people would understand that, but I do think atheists have a hard time accepting that for whatever reason. But you're right. It seems to me that if you say you don't have one, what you're saying is, I've never thought about reality at all. I have no consistent ideas in my head. I mean, that's just
sure,
silly.
Sure. Well, I guess it's fair to say, I mean, it would be fair if someone said, well, I didn't realize I had a worldview, or I'm not mindful of it. And that's true. I'm sure a lot of people don't think, I have a worldview and it entails this, this, and that.
Right.
But for these people, it sounds like they know what a worldview is, and they're denying they have a worldview, which is a pretty incredible claim. Because obviously the fact that they're claiming they don't have a worldview is part of their worldview in itself. So.
Right.
There's certainly a problem with that.
Well, I'm hoping they keep reading the posts and maybe they'll change their minds. And maybe you listeners can come on there and help change their minds.
So
we'd love to have more commenters.
Is it too late for people to join this book club? Or
what? No. You can come anytime. And in fact, I'll put a link up tomorrow to if you buy the book through our store, you'll get the interview on CD with Nancy Piercy. And you'll get 15% off if you use the special code that that we have posted for the book club. So you can always join in. We're just starting, I think this week is the third chapter. I think we're on the third chapter this week.
Mm-hmm.
So we haven't gone that far. It's not too late.
Right. And what's the format of the post that you put? Is it on Friday?
It's on Friday.
It's on Friday. So what's the format of that post? What are you writing there such that people have a opportunity to interact?
Well, the first couple of weeks, I've kind of summarized, because the first week especially, she gives a whole kind of outline of how her book's going to go. So I just kind of summarized it. But I'm probably going to change that and start maybe giving my ideas about a certain point, and then people can just say what they think, post whatever they thought was interesting, and just have some conversation.
All right, cool. That sounds like a great idea. Okay, we are running up here at the end of the first hour at Stand to Reason. And so if you have another hour afterwards, please join us. After the break, we will be back with you. Again, this is Alan Schliemann and Amy Hall. We are guest hosting for Greg Kokel, who has a day off. Thanks for joining us for this hour. See you in the next hour. I'm Alan Schliemann and Amy Hall. Bye. Welcome to Stand to Reason. This is Alan Schliemann. I'm guest hosting with my colleague and friend, Amy Hall, blogger extraordinaire. We're excited to have her as part of the team. We are filling in for Greg, who has the day off today. And so we are giving him some much needed rest and some things that he wanted to take care of with his family. So we're excited to be able to afford him that opportunity. If you want to call in and ask us a question or join in the live podcast today, you can call us within the United States here. The number is 855-243-9975. If you're calling from outside of the United States, the number is 562-424-8229. And we are seeing some people already calling in, so that's great if you want to get into the queue. We just have a couple of comments we wanted to make here before we jump into some of these caller questions. And in particular, I wanted to comment on this particular story that's popped up a couple of times here in the last few years. And it's regarding some high schools that have had a Muslim, or at least an Arabic speaker, but most likely this person was a Muslim, recite the Pledge of Allegiance over the intercom, over the speakers, to the students in Arabic as a part of diversity, multiculturalism, whatever it might be. And I've seen this come up in Colorado, I think a year or two ago. Just last month, there was another school in New York that did the same thing. And I'm not so much wanting to bring up the question of whether it's justified or legitimate to recite the Pledge of Allegiance in Arabic. That's not necessarily what I'm concerned about bringing up. Rather, I'm curious about a comment that was made by a man named Ibrahim Hooper, who is part of the Council of American Islamic Relations. Now, the Council of American Islamic Relations, or CAIR, C-A-I-R, is, I think, one of the largest Muslim American advocacy groups in the United States. I think they're based out of Washington, D.C., and they do a lot to try to promote Muslim American relations. And this particular gentleman, as a part of CAIR, made a comment defending the use of the term Allah in the Pledge of Allegiance, because obviously when they say the Pledge of Allegiance in Arabic, they say one nation under Allah. And this is, of course, what sparked a lot of controversy and concern by many people in the school and, of course, parents and other people. But in response to this, the person from the Council of American Islamic Relations said this: look, it's okay to say the word Allah when you're saying one nation under Allah, because obviously in Arabic, he writes, you would use the word Allah, but Christian Arabs would also use the word Allah. It's not necessarily specific to Islam and Muslims. In other words, he's saying, it's no big deal. Saying Allah in the Pledge of Allegiance doesn't necessarily imply Islam. It's just a generic term for God. Now, in one sense, I agree with what he's saying. And the reason why I say that is because I'm an Assyrian. And when I say Assyrian, I'm not to be confused with Syria and Syrians, which is a country in the Middle East today. I'm Assyrian, which is the Old Testament people that you probably perhaps read about. They were, unfortunately for me, the enemies of Israel and consequently the enemies of God. So that's kind of a bummer for me when I was growing up and having my parents tell me, hey, guess what? You know, our people are talked about in the Bible. You know what? We're the bad guys, you know. But I got over that with a little bit of counseling and therapy. Anyways, all that being set aside here, the point that this gentleman from CAIR was making is that it's no big deal to say Allah or one nation under Allah, because after all, Allah simply means God in Arabic. Now, for me as an Assyrian, when I say the word God, because I speak Assyrian fluently with my family, I also use a term that sounds a lot like Allah. In fact, the word is Allaha. And it sounds a lot like Allah because actually Assyrian and Arabic are both Semitic languages. They have a similar Aramaic root. And so I too, as a Christian, as an Assyrian, when I say God in my own language, I say Allah or Allaha. Now, there's no confusion for myself or for other Assyrian speakers when I say this, because in Assyrian, that's the way the term is. However, I want to make a distinction that when you say the word Allah in English, it doesn't have the same effect. And the reason is because there's another word that we often use in English for God, and that is God or Lord or something else like that. And so when a person says a law in English, then it carries a completely different understanding, and it's clearly now delineating the Islamic notion of God. And so that's why, again, I'm not necessarily arguing for or against whether the Pledge of Allegiance should be recited in Arabic or not. I'm simply making the point that this guy who says, look, hey, Christians who are Arabic speaking often use the term Allah anyways when they're speaking their own language. Yes, that's true. But when it comes to the English language, it doesn't apply. Because when you say Allah in English, then, of course, it connotates the Islamic notion of God. Whereas in Assyrian, for example, or in Arabic, it doesn't. And so that's why I think you have to make this important distinction, since it works in one language but not the other. All right. Well, so that's all for that. I just wanted to we want to turn now to the calls. I see, is it Nick in Calgary has a question. Nick, you're on the show, Stand to Reason, with Amy and Alan. How's it going?
Not too bad. How are you guys doing?
Good. We were just in Calgary. Were you able to attend the event where me, Greg, Brett Kunkel?
Yeah, I did. I met you there briefly. You were a busy guy. I know I kind of volunteer with JoJo with Faith Beyond Belief, and actually my best friend Andres was the one that was driving you around everywhere.
Oh yes, so. That's awesome. Yeah, wonderful. Well, yeah, Andres was wonderful. He was one of my two drivers. It was amazing to have drivers that were taking me all across Calgary and Alberta. In fact, Andres is the one who said to me, "Hey, you know, do you want a break?" And I said, "Sure, let's go to I think it was Banff and Lake Louise." And so he drove me one morning all the way out there, and we had a great time talking. What a fantastic individual. Be sure to tell him I said hello, and I miss him already because he gave me my one day of rest in Calgary.
Oh, yeah. JoJo had you running around like crazy. I saw your schedule, and I was like, oh, my gosh.
I think I had 24 events or presentations in 6 days of speaking. It was quite amazing. So I think JoJo did a great job with setting that all up. And
maybe that was the only way for you to keep warm while you were up there.
That's right. It was pretty cool.
I don't think it was that cold. Well, I mean, you Californians.
Of course you wouldn't.
I guess you guys are
not
so tough in that area. I can understand. I would probably be the same way.
Yeah. I mean, on Christmas Day here in San Diego, where I live, we had the air conditioning on, cooling the house. So it was a little bit of a...
I don't want to talk about that anymore, okay?
Okay, all right, let's get to the real question here.
It's going to cause bitterness, and I don't think I should be...
That's right, and then we'd have to pray for you, and we wouldn't get your call.
Exactly.
Yeah, so what's on your mind, Eric? Oh, I'm sorry, Nick.
No, that's okay. I'm a blogger myself. I mean, I probably don't have quite the following that somebody like Amy does, but... I get an occasional interaction with atheists, and I've been doing this apologetics blog for us. Apologetics is not new to me. I blogged on the problem of evil, similarly following along the lines of the stuff that Greg and has talked about, and even you basically kind of talking about how the problem of evil is everybody's problem, not just the Christian's problem. And I got this interesting objection. It kind of seems like nonsense, but I wanted to run it by you because, you know, I thought Greg, but I figure you guys should have some good stuff to say too. Basically, this guy said that because in his worldview, evil, there is no evil, that unless I define what evil is, because when he first gave me this kind of objection, I kind of described a bunch of clearly reprehensible moral acts, you know, things like the Holocaust or child abuse or rape, you know, standard, you know, clear-cut examples of what evil is. And he said, sounds funny. He said, you're giving me examples of evil, but you're not defining what evil is. I'm like, well, how can I be giving you examples of evil if there's no such thing as evil? Like, then you're switching categories as well. But anyways, I don't know if you've ever heard that before. It seems almost like the idea I got was that the guy was saying, basically, if you don't give me some sort of all-encompassing dictionary definition type thing, definition of evil that I'm willing to accept, then you have failed to prove that evil's a real thing, kind of thing. It's kind of what he was getting at, but I don't know if you've heard anything like that before.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Was he denying there is evil?
Basically, yeah. I mean, I think that's absurd, obviously, but basically he's saying in his worldview, because he's an atheist, this guy, he says that there is no such thing as evil. And unless I can define it for him, what is evil as a definition, not as an example, this is what his claim is, then there is no conversation to be had.
Yeah, what's interesting about this is that I actually find myself in the opposite role when I'm talking to an atheist, making the claim that he's making. In fact, oftentimes when an atheist or someone who, you know, maybe is a skeptic, claims that he doesn't believe in God because he thinks that evil is a problem for God's existence, I'm the one who then says to him, well, what do you mean by evil? Could you define for me evil? Is evil real? And they are the ones who often will give me examples of evil. Say, well, like rape and torture and murder. And I say, no. Those are all examples of evil. Could you define for me what evil is? You know, now there's a reason why I'm asking him to define for me what evil is, because obviously in order for him to define evil, he'll have to somehow appeal to an objective standard of goodness by which we can say evil is a departure from it. And of course, that has implications for theism. So I'm not answering your question just yet here, but I'm interested in the way you told me the story went, because I'm the one who oftentimes is pressing the atheist on what.
As did I. That's exactly what I did too. I did the same thing as the pretty standard response.
So you said that he's the one who challenged you to give a definition for evil. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, well, I wrote basically, my blog was basically saying that atheists have to explain evil just like, you know, with some objective standard. They acknowledge evil, right? So they have to explain where that standard comes from. And he basically said, I don't believe in evil, or I don't believe that evil is such a thing. It's something, it's a category that theists have created. And if you want to talk about evil, then you need to define it for me. So I gave him examples of of all the things that, you know, atheists usually give you, you know.
Sure. Does he think that evil or the reality of evil is a problem for God's existence?
It doesn't seem that that's the case. It seems like what he's trying to be philosophically consistent, I think, within his worldview. So he's trying to assert that since he's an atheist, there is no such thing as objective morality, and therefore evil does not exist. Now, I basically told him, I have a feeling you're probably pretty inconsistent on this issue, you know, in real life.
Mm-hmm.
But I found his objection original in a sense, because I've never heard anybody, well, you can't talk about evil unless you define it for me. So I didn't know if that was something that you guys even heard before. It sounds really weird.
Well, I wouldn't feel like, I wouldn't feel like this is a problem, because usually the problem of evil is raised as an objection against God's existence. But if he's not offering it as an argument against God's existence, then I wouldn't say anything about it per se.
Well, he's just using that to refute your post. That's basically the problem here, right?
Yeah, he's rejecting my claim that the problem of evil is a problem for atheists as well as theists. He's saying that it's only a problem for theists because you're the only ones who have those categories,
well,
kind of thing.
In a way, I mean, he's right. I don't think I could define evil in an atheist worldview. I mean, I could just say maybe it's something that causes me intense pain or something I really don't like. So he's right about that. I think the only way I could define evil is to say it's a, you know, deprivation of what's good, and it's not the, you know, it's when things aren't the way they're supposed to be, when it deviates from the standard of God's character, all sorts of those things. But those all make reference to God. So and obviously he's not going to accept that. So I don't think any definition is going to be persuasive to him. But the problem for him is that we apprehend evil. We, as human beings, we apprehend good and we apprehend evil, and he knows there's evil. And that's why you have the advantage right now, because he knows there's evil. No matter what he's saying with his mouth, we know that he knows evil exists. So at that point, maybe the best thing to do on the blog is just to try and bring that out somehow, or at least make it clear to the other readers, right?
Mm-hmm.
maybe make a list of all sorts of evil things and say, so-and-so yeah. says these things are not evil. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I pretty much, I did almost exactly that. Like, I'm tracking right along with you. You're handling it exactly the same way I did. I even said, like, what if, you know, one of your closest loved ones, maybe you don't have kids, maybe you're not married, but your closest loved ones was kidnapped and tortured and murdered, and, you know, what would you call that? You know, like, if evil's not a category, what would you call that? Purple? I don't know, like, you know what I mean?
What did he say?
He didn't say anything. Oh, you haven't. He just. It didn't seem like a good objection to me. It just seemed unique. I guess.
I think that's the right answer to ask him to define what that is. So if that's not evil, what is it? What do you call it?
Yeah.
That make him explain what that is, or what the quality of that is. How would you mm-hmm. describe this quality?
Yeah. No. It seemed like he was. Basically appealing to some sort of like a minimalist kind of ethic, like if it harms somebody, then we don't like it because that's what evolution produced, sort of thing. You know,
yeah.
So we don't like to be harmed, so we won't harm other people. You know, supposedly.
Yeah, I mean, I think the point Amy's making here too is that he has to account for why things are wrong at some point. I mean, it sounds like what Amy's pointing out here is that intuitively he knows there's some things that are amiss with the world.
Mm-hmm.
And how under his worldview, kind of like what we were talking about earlier about worldview, that even the atheist has a worldview to defend. And in his worldview, he says, well, there is no evil. Okay, so what do you call things like if somebody, you know, murders your mother, or the Third Reich? How do you account for that? What is that? Is that wrong? And on your view, the atheist worldview, they have no way to justify saying that what the Third Reich did to the Jews and to many other people was wrong. Mm-hmm. And any moral system that can't hold the Third Reich accountable would be a bankrupt moral system. And so this is why you want to hold them accountable to that. So, again, I don't see this as necessarily him arguing, like you pointed out. He's not saying that, well, I don't believe in God because of evil. He's saying, no, I don't believe even in what evil is. And he's sort of trying to put the burden of proof upon you.
And here's another idea of something you might be able to do. Because you said that he said it's just something that we don't like, correct? Is that what he said?
Basically, yeah. Good and evil are human categories. They always refer to humans or something like that. And so... basically trying to say that they're every, you know, all moral judgments are just subjective value judgments kind
of
thing.
So maybe there's a way to kind of bring out the difference of the quality by saying, you know, sometimes on Survivor they eat live things that are moving. I mean, that's pretty gross. I would really dislike that. And sometimes people behead living people. Now, I don't like either of those. Are you saying it's the same kind of not liking, or is there another quality that makes them different? I think mm-hmm. that brings out the idea that this is more than just I don't like it. There is a quality to it that is beyond just distaste. That he can't account for that, but he should be made to.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, it's hard. That's the one thing that's disadvantageous about having a sort of a blog debate is that you can't ask. The tactics don't work as well.
That's true. So,
well, sometimes
you ask somebody, you know, like, well, what do you mean by that? And they might not even write back, you know. And you're like, oh man, I had a good response waiting for him, but
that's true.
I feel your pain.
But sometimes, though, even on a blog, that you have the opportunity to sort of narrate what's happening, you know. And I don't know if you've heard of this notion of narrating the debate, where you kind of step mm-hmm. back and got to give a third person perspective of what's going on. And so this allows not only the person you're talking to have a sense of the point you're making and maybe how their response has worked or not worked, but it allows other people who are reading your blog to get a sense of what's going on and for you to restate certain things. William Lane mm-hmm. Craig, for example, is a master at narrating the debate. So I think, yeah, you're right. Sometimes on a blog, it's not the most conducive to these kinds of conversations, but you still have the opportunity to think through your comments and your posts before you write it. And then I think narrating the debate might help with that. But it also seems to me that in this case, I'm just thinking, if I was in your situation, I would probably just shift the whole conversation back to the question of atheism and saying, look, let's talk about theism and atheism, because you're right. At the end of the day, evil and good for that matter, are meaningless statements in a world without God. And so it's like, how are you expected to eventually define evil if you don't have the ability to appeal to God? And so I think it almost seems like you need to step back to a more foundational level of the conversation and in your apologetic and try to make a positive defense for God's existence before you can start talking about good and evil. Because again, usually when I define evil, it's always in a defense responding to the objection that God can't exist if evil exists, you know?
And that's me too. Yeah. It's always the way it goes. It's, as I said, it's the first time I've ever heard somebody kind of switch it, and it's not like it really stumped me. It actually seemed like a really dumb objection, but then I was like, well, maybe there's something deeply philosophical behind it that I thought I, you know, like I've heard Rabbi Zacharias say that one day some philosopher asked him to define evil for him, and I couldn't remember his answer, but I thought it was really good.
Right. Right. Yeah. Well, I usually, you know, usually in the case of defending against the objection of evil as an argument against God's existence, I always say, look, evil is not a thing. It's the absence of something. And then, you know, I give the illustration, you know, what is a donut hole? You know, and people say, well, it's that thing that you eat. And I say, no. A donut hole is the place where there is no donut, you know. The circle, the empty part where there is no donut. That's not where I want to be, by the way. Or then I ask, you know, well, what is coldness? I say, it's the absence of heat. It's the place where there is no heat. You know, what is darkness? It's the place where there is no light. And notice all of these things are defined not by what they are, but by what they are not. And so this is how I introduce the idea of evil being not something that, say, God created, for example, but rather the absence of something. And so again, but this all falls under the framework of explaining how evil is not a problem for God's existence, which is why my suggestion to you is to sort of back up from the whole good and evil question and go down to more foundational level and start engaging on the question of, you know, what reasons do we have for thinking God exists? What reasons do we have for thinking that atheism is a better explanation for the world, you know, the existence of the universe, morality, and all of the other things that he might considered to be true.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Does that help, Nick?
Yeah, I think so. I was kind of thinking along the same lines, but it was nice to pick your minds, because Greg would correct me if I said pick your brain.
Go ahead, Nick.
No, that's fine. Go ahead.
I think you have to be okay with the fact that he's probably not going to come around on your blog. And
I figured as much. I was pretty much considering abandoning the conversation for the most part, because I mean, anybody who's going to deny the reality of evil, I don't know how you even reason with somebody. I mean, they pretty much just have to get hit with it in real life to kind of drop the dumb objection like that they have to even the existence of evil. I think that's kind of the way God works with people when they're that stubborn, like, you don't believe in evil? Well, one day you'll experience it, and then you won't be able to deny it anymore, and maybe you'll become some form of objectivist. But
yeah, sure, sure. Take a large wrench and hit him on the head with it and ask him if that's evil.
Or something. Maybe I can download a virus and send it to him. It's here, remember?
Yeah, what do you think about that?
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Sometimes these people, they have to bump up into reality, like you said, before they realize that their deepest intuitions then sort of rise to the surface and they become aware, oh, yeah, okay, these things are real. Okay. Well, thanks for your call, Nick. We appreciate it.
Yeah, no, thanks a lot, guys. It was good talking to you.
All right. Yeah, it was good. Sorry we didn't get a chance to talk when I was up in Calgary, but chances are we'll be back up there again within the next year. So if I'm up there again, be sure to come up and say hello.
That would be great.
All right. Take care.
Okay, well, I'll tell Andres he said hi.
All right, I will. Yes, do tell him. Bye, Nick.
Okay, bye.
Okay, we got to take a break here. This is, again, Amy Hall and Alan Schliemann filling in for Greg, who has the night off. We'll be back again after the break with your questions.
Do you want to become a more equipped Christian ambassador? One of the best ways to do so is waiting for you now at str.org, and it's free. Just visit the homepage at str.org and click on Subscriptions at the top. From there, you can choose to receive newsletters, updates, and training resources delivered to your inbox for free. You can choose from Greg's Mentoring Letter, Ambassador Insights, Tactics, Solid Ground, STR E-News from Greg, as well as monthly newsletters from Brett and Alan, and more. They are all loaded with practical, concise, useful tools to help you be a better ambassador for Christ. And they're all free and easy to share with friends. So elevate your expertise as a Christian ambassador right now. Visit str.org, click on subscriptions, and take advantage of what's waiting for you there.
Are you a student with hard questions about God, Jesus, or the Bible? Or do you have a student in your life who is asking questions that you aren't prepared to answer? Then it's time to pay a visit to the student resources page at strnextgen.com, where you'll find tons of fresh and compelling information for students, parents, and youth leaders. It's a rich collection of articles and videos, including responses to common objections about the Christian faith. And there's even a place where you can invite me, Brett Kunkel, to speak at your local school or church. So head over to the student resources page today. Just visit strnextgen.com.
Okay, this is Stand to Reason, the show where we talk about being an effective ambassador for Jesus Christ and just seeing how that intersects with all of the challenges that we face as believers in this world. And there's lots of things that are raised up against the Christian worldview. And so we want to engage those things in a way that exemplifies the characteristics of an ambassador. We want to jump right here to your calls. We got Jay on the line here. Jay, hello. This is Amy and Alan with you on Stand to Reason.
Hi, Amy and Alan.
Hey, Jay.
Hey.
You're in, where are you calling from, Jay?
I'm calling from Princeton, New Jersey.
Okay, great. And what's on your mind?
I'm calling because I'm a student at the seminary here in Princeton, and this week is what's called BGLAS Week, which is their own acronym for the Common LGBTQ, whatever else, thing. And so they have, they're having like luncheons and they're giving out free t-shirts and stuff like that. And I'm just calling to see if I could get some advice on how to address my lack of participation in the celebration, how to address that very briefly when people ask me. Because I kind of know where I stand, but not everyone has the time. Well, sit down, you know, here, sit down and let me tell you about this, you know.
And this is specifically in the seminary, or is this in Princeton?
Yeah, this is in the seminary.
Do you know how they, I mean, I'm just curious how they, on their, according to their own view, how they justify this? Like, what is it entailing? Is it just simply saying, look, we care about homosexual people, they are made in the image of God as well, or are they actually advancing pro-gay theology or other kinds of things that perhaps you would find unbiblical?
Yeah, they, Princeton Seminary is a PCUSA, which just recently passed in their bylaws or whatever you call it.
Yes.
They just basically made same-sex marriage acceptable. And so this is just, In my opinion, them capitulating in some sense. So they, to really get into how they justify it, you have to go back to their doctrine of scripture, which is not nearly as tight, I think, as more evangelical approaches. So their attitude of this is more like, you know, we want to be, you know, we want to be on the cutting edge. This is one of the things I learned about going to, you know, a well-named or whatever seminary. They have a reputation to guard, and so they are very conscious about their presence in front of the whole world, and so they're trying to keep up, you know, with the progress. You know, they don't want to fall behind Yale or Harvard or something like that, you know. So I think a lot of it is really just trying to maintain a certain kind of reputation than sort of, like, I think that really drives it, and then there's the sort of theological justification that sort of follows that too.
Yeah, yeah, and yeah, we're familiar with the PCUSA decision, and yeah, that of course was unfortunate. So, I guess let me offer my comments, and perhaps Amy has some thoughts about this as well, perhaps as well. But it strikes me, since we're talking about Princeton Seminary, as Amy was asking about, we're dealing then with people who are claiming at least to be Christian in terms of their theology or their own convictions, and then adopting what seems to be a position that is unbiblical. So I don't, I don't know. I mean, if I was in your situation, I don't know if I would say anything other than something as straightforward as, well, if I was to be asked, why am I not participating in it? Say, well, I don't think that homosexual behavior is something that it should be celebrated when the Bible clearly teaches that that behavior is sinful. And again, notice I say behavior because what the Bible prohibits is homosexual behavior. It doesn't necessarily say that, you know, merely having same-sex attractions is wrong or sinful. So it's not that you're saying that you're against people, that you hate homosexuals. What you're simply doing is affirming what biblical what the Bible says, and that is that homosexual behavior is wrong. So I'm not sure that I would say, at least initially, anything other than, well, I'm not participating in it because I can't participate in what the Bible says is sin. We have to, as Christians, affirm what God affirms and reject what God rejects. So I think I would probably just begin with saying that and seeing what their response, if there is a response to that, and then go from there.
Yeah, I, because I'm assuming you want to do this in a way that doesn't cause more problems for yourself. I'm trying to think about a way to say this. I think there's a way to do this where you make it clear, because when you think about why is it that you don't want to participate? Ultimately, the reason why you don't want to participate isn't that you think it's breaking a rule that you don't think they should break. Ultimately, the problem is these people are damaging themselves. They're promoting something that's going to hurt them. I mean, that if you can couch this in terms of your concern for the people, because that's the reason why they're holding this event, is to show concern and to build people up. And you think that actually works against their goal. Promoting homosexuality is actually working against their goal to build these people up and to encourage them. So maybe you could just say something like, you know, I really think that God created us to express our sexuality in a particular way, and I really believe that they're hurting themselves by doing this, and I can't encourage that. I can't encourage them to hurt themselves. That's my conviction, and I would love to talk to them. Maybe you could even say, I'd love to talk to you more about this, because I know you asked for a quick answer, because it's difficult to do this all at once. But just be open. Say, I know you probably disagree, and I'd love to talk to you more about this and tell you why I think that and hear what you have to say. That way you're keeping it kind of focused on your concern for them, and also open. You're open. You're not an angry, I'm walking away from you. You're saying, I'd love to engage you on this. I'd love to try and convince you about this and tell you why I think this.
Yeah.
So what do you think? I'm curious just to get your thoughts on that. I mean, if you just simply stated kind of the obvious position and saying, look, you know, because we're dealing with the Bible here, and obviously as being a seminary, we're trying to uphold what Scripture says. What's wrong with just simply saying, look, I can't affirm what's something that God rejects?
Yeah, I don't see anything wrong, you know, morally with saying that, but as far as effectiveness goes, life on the campus is it's so different. You would not, if someone were blindfolded and you took down all the signs that said seminary, you may not get that impression just from, or that this is a seminary where people actually like want to follow the teachings of Scripture. You wouldn't get that impression just from seminary life.
Okay, so I assume that, but even so, let's just say they asked you, and again, I realize that every conversation would be different based on the context, who you're speaking to. Is it a classmate that's asking you? Is it just some random person who's passing out flyers and saying, "Hey, participate"?
Right, no, yeah, you know, this has been a practicing homosexuals on campus. So it's very personal to them. It's not me having like a safe conversation with an impartial party or something like that.
So are these people that you know personally that are asking you why, or are you you're anticipating?
Well, one of them was today, and he didn't ask me why. He just said, "Hey, did you get your big glass T-shirt and all that?" And I was like, "No." And he said, "Oh, well, they're giving them away for free." And I said, "Oh, okay." Like I didn't really know what to say. I didn't want to be like, "Well, no, we're not going to get one of your T-shirts because I think what you're doing is, you know, like right in their face like that."
You know, this might be a good chance to use Columbo and just say, "What do you think about this? Why do you think that? You know, just start asking him questions. Get him talking about it.
Right. That's why I like your answer, Amy, about just simply asking, "Well, what's this event about? What's being celebrated? Why does this event exist?" And then from there, saying, "I am with you in wanting to affirm all human beings that God has made and that God loves and that He loves enough to die for. And so I want to affirm every single human being that exists. But at the same time, I don't want to affirm behaviors that I think are harmful to them."
Mm-hmm.
And so So you can stand with them in one sense and saying, "Yeah, I want to affirm all human beings for what they are," and find a sort of common ground there, and then show why I think doing what they're doing is not actually helping but harming.
Yeah.
I think that would be the best approach, or just because I know so many students here personally, what they'll say if you say, "Well, the Bible doesn't teach this," they'll say, "Well, you're reading the Bible literally," and for them that's a pejorative term. You're a literalist. Oh, it's so arcane, so archaic. It's almost like you don't have a conversation. It's mm-hmm. like they've been over that for like 100 years, so they're just waiting for everyone else to get over it too. That's the sort of attitude that pervades. So it's difficult to bring up the biblical argument, because they just simply will not argue with you that way. They'll throw you into that a certain category and say, "Well, I don't have to deal with you."
Are you unusual at Princeton? Do you have like-minded friends? Or
I have some. There are actually a lot of evangelicals, but they're very quiet and they're kind of ducking and hiding.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a contingency, a sizable contingency. It's just they're not very vocal in the social world. We have like prayer groups and Bible studies and stuff that we do, and I sort of ask questions of the professors that other people are scared to ask.
Mm-hmm.
So there's not a whole lot of basically there's a social climate there, and evangelicals who are on campus tend to take a more quietist sort of approach. Well, you just simply don't engage, you know. Simply don't participate.
And just out of curiosity, how is it that you have remained conservative there?
Well, because I I think for me, I had a good foundation, and I don't. I recognize the social pressure, because the reality is, with most of what gets students is socialization. They don't necessarily get won over by argument. Sometimes they do,
mm-hmm.
but for the most part, there's an enormous amount of social pressure, especially for students who have basically been going to school since they were 5 years old and they've never left. So all they really had is a peer group. I spent 3 years working before I went to undergrad, and I worked my way through my undergrad, and then I spent 4 more years working and saving up money after undergrad. So I'm older than most of the students, and I've experienced enough of the world, I think, to where I understand social pressures, and I kind of know where I stand intellectually before I even came here. I don't necessarily close myself off to arguments, but I really haven't found what they've said convincing. But like I said, what people are convinced by isn't necessarily arguments. It's socially, like, there's an enormous amount of pressure to conform, be because you'll look bad if you disagree on certain things.
Yeah, I think what you've said is really insightful, and I think social pressure is something, and Greg has talked about this a lot, that's something we're all going to have to get good at. It's just, it's very sad to me that it's it's something you have to deal with at a seminary. That's just, that's very sad. But it's just a microcosm of our society now. And I think
Well, to be fair, I did my undergrad at Multnomah University, which is a pretty conservative Bible. Well, it used to be a Bible college, now it's a university. And anywhere you go, I'm sure, you know, if you were a liberal going in there, you would feel social pressures. That doesn't make a conservative view wrong, but certainly any social group has other people or other groups that kind of end up becoming their punching bag or whatever. It's just that this school of evangelicals are the punching bag.
Yeah, it's interesting, as Amy has identified, you know, the point you're making here about socialization and how powerful it is. I don't know if you're familiar with the Reformation Project or other of these organizations that identify or claim to be Christian but are trying to advance a form of pro-gay theology. Are you familiar with any of these?
Yeah.
So it's interesting because I attended one of the trainings, and they also said something very similar to what you just said, and that is they said, look, we're not counting on the fact that people are going to be persuaded by arguments alone. Instead, what we want to do is encourage conservative Christians to be able to build, we want to make sure that conservative Christians are forced to be in relationships in social situations with other Christians who claim to be gay Christians. And by virtue of that socialization, by virtue of the fact that they'll have friends who are pressuring them to agree with them, by virtue of the fact that they might have children who are saying, Mom, Dad, I'm gay, but I still want to be a Christian. By virtue of all of that social pressure, they are counting on the fact that this will then make them more open to considering these arguments, which, as you probably pointed out earlier, they're usually not compelling. They're not persuasive. But if you add the element of social pressure and of a desire by all of us to want to accept other people, not just in who they are, but also in what they're doing, because there is that temptation. I find that same temptation in myself, that it will then allow people to be more persuaded by the arguments that aren't necessarily very good. And it sounds like that's what you're saying is happening, you know, either in Princeton or other places.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, you're a brave man. We applaud you for being courageous and standing up for the truth, even in an environment that's quite hostile.
It's hard. You gotta find other people with you, but it's especially hard to do it. It's hardest to do it publicly. I don't know. I try to do it one conversation, one person at a time, you know, over the lunch table or whatever. Because oftentimes I've found that if I stand up in, like, a classroom or whatever, professors and students kind of have reputations to protect, and so they're not as open to listening as they are in, like, a one-on-one conversation.
And, you know, you're doing us all a service when you do that, because I think there's a big problem with people who are on the other side assuming that everyone on our side is mean and bigoted and evil. But when they talk to you, they can see that that's not true. And that at least helps them to be maybe less intimidating towards other people in the future. So that every time you do that, you're helping everybody when you do that.
Well, I hope so. a contingency and I have been praying for things to change at the seminary. We're just hoping that prayer and standing up and speaking the truth will make a difference. So we'll see.
Yeah, well, you're doing the right thing. As we said, you know, we're all ambassadors for Jesus Christ, and we are called to proclaim the message of reconciliation. And it sounds like you're right in the midst of a situation in which you have to be an ambassador to, unfortunately, a seminary claiming to be at least in line with Scripture to a certain degree. But you're having to be an ambassador to a people group who doesn't even acknowledge what Scripture teaches. So we applaud you, like I said, for being a good ambassador in that way.
Thanks.
Yeah. Well, nice talking to you, Jay. We appreciate your call. All right. Well, take care.
Alrighty, bye-bye.
All right, bye.
Ellen, I have a new respect for Greg sitting in this very warm room for 3 hours. I had no idea it was this warm in here.
Yeah, it's gotten a little bit warm here, but that's okay because we're wrapping up here. But, you know, it just the whole story with Jay just reminds me again of why Stand to Reason and what Greg's doing, what you're doing, what I'm doing, what all of us at Stand to Reason are doing, and that is trying to help prepare believers for the world that oftentimes is pretty hostile towards the Christian worldview. And even in situations in which we're with Christians or with believers or with people who, you know, or with organizations that are allegedly are Christian, we're still facing opposition. And I think that's going to be a recurrent theme for the next decade, especially with regards to the issue of homosexuality, which I know we talked about, but also got a couple of calls about.
You know, I wonder if, you know, there has been such a movement in apologetics over the last 10, 15 years, maybe 20. Mm-hmm. And I almost, you know, I wonder, was God preparing us for that, for what we would face now? Because without any knowledge or reasons in our minds, there's no way any of us would withstand the social pressure.
Yeah, yeah. Well, hopefully he's done a good job preparing us, because we're all in for quite a challenge in the next few years. Okay, well, I think that wraps up our time this evening. Again, my name's Alan Schliemann. I'm guest hosting here with Amy Hall, our other staff person here at Stand to Reason. We're just filling in for Greg Kokel today, who's got the night off. It was a pleasure to take your calls and to chat with you this evening about Christianity and the intersection of the Christian worldview with lots of ideas that we face with each day. Thanks for your time, and we enjoyed talking to you. We'll be back next week, or actually Greg will be back next week with your calls again at the same time. See you then. Bye.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.